From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. William Shawcross was one of the first journalists to investigate the stories of Cambodians who became refugees under the bloody rule of the Khmer Rouge. This led to books on America's secret bombing of Cambodia and the international response to the genocide under the Khmer Rouge. On today's Fresh Air, William Shawcross looks at what he calls the Fourth World, the world of the 14 million refugees scattered around the globe. Also today, we meet one of America's most honored poets, Galway Kinnell, and he reads from his new unpublished poem, When One Has Lived a Long Time Alone. And rock historian Ed Ward profiles R&B artist William Bell. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Journalist William Shawcross writes, a real picture of the world today would show millions of homeless men, women, and children being forced from north, south, east, and west, often with no clear destination in sight, with little hope of return. It is a phenomenon that is intolerable. That's from the introduction Shawcross wrote to the new book, Forced Out, The Agony of the Refugee in Our Time. Shawcross's coverage of refugees dates back to 1970, when he started covering the war in Vietnam for the Sunday Times of London. This eventually led to his 1979 book, Sideshow, Kissinger, Nixon, and the Destruction of Cambodia. About America's secret bombing of Cambodia, Shawcross wrote, "It was not a mistake, it was a crime." His next book, The Quality of Mercy, examined the international response to the genocide in Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge. Last year, Shawcross completed his book, The Shah's Last Ride, an investigation into the exile of the Shah of Iran and his attempts to gain asylum from the countries he thought were his allies. William Shawcross lives in England, but he's joining us today from the NPR Bureau in New York. He told me he thinks of the refugees as the people of the Fourth World.
There are 14 million refugees in the world today, and they are really an unseen world in a way, and we pay far too little attention to them. But 14 million people is bigger than many, many countries in the United Nations, and these refugees have no representation at all.
You describe something that you've given the name of compassion fatigue. Describe what you mean by that.
It's a terrible sickness. It's a sort of modern sickness, rather like AIDS. It's caused, I think, by the speed and the plethora of modern communications. The fact that you can be in touch instantaneously with almost any part of the world, and images of any part of the world can be beamed up and down to any other part of the world by satellite. And I think, for example, I would take the case of the Vietnamese boat people. In the late 1970s, when they first began to sail out of Vietnam, they aroused enormous sympathy and compassion. Now, 10 years later, Vietnamese boat people are still coming out of Vietnam, but they don't arouse any compassion at all. In fact, they arouse, if anything, impatience. And the world has moved on. Vietnam hasn't changed very much, and the problems which forced people to leave are similar today to those which they were 10 years ago. But the rest of the world has moved on, and we've been assaulted by other images, if you like, and other appeals to our conscience since the boat people began 10 years ago. One of the most notable ones, of course, is was the famine in Ethiopia in 84-85. Now there's a new famine in Sudan. There has been continual warfare and suffering in Central America. Those are just a few of the vast number of images that succeed each other showing suffering all over the world. And I think it is fatiguing, and I'm not surprised that people should feel compassion fatigue, but it is dangerous, and it is above all destructive for those for whom we are trying to feel compassion, like, for example, the boat people, whose fate today is much more uncertain than it was 10 years ago.
Do you think that one of the things that contributes to compassion fatigue is that causes almost become trendy, and because of that they later seem like, well, we thought about that cause already, we're on to a new one, that cause is old hat?
Yes, I think that's true. There are fashions in refugees and disasters, and the Vietnamese have suffered from that problem. And others also. Central America is almost just sort of part of the wallpaper now also.
Do you think that concert benefits like Live Aid contribute to compassion fatigue?
I don't think so, no. I think that would be very unfair for all of those who took part and helped organize and also just participated in Live Aid. No, I think that actually helps remind one of the continuing disastrous situation, the continuing crisis, if you like, in which millions of people are still living. And I think it was very successful in that way.
My guest is journalist William Shawcross, and he wrote an introduction to this new book, Forced Out, about refugees around the world. In your book, The Quality of Mercy, you ask the question, how is it and why is it that a disaster suddenly becomes elevated to the level of cause célèbre? How does it suddenly penetrate the international consciousness? What are some of the answers you've come up to that question? I think it's a very interesting question to ask.
Yes, and it's a very difficult question to answer. And I don't think I have found any really satisfactory answers, or certainly not any cast iron ones on which I would say this is the answer to that question. I think that the most terrifying answer to it is that something has to be enormous before it achieves critical mass, I think was the word I used for it. The disaster in Cambodia had been going on a very long time before it became a cause célèbre in 1979. It took 2 million deaths under the Khmer Rouge and then a terrible specter of famine hanging over the survivors in Cambodia before the rest of the world woke up to the disaster. The Vietnamese boat people had to come out in hundreds of thousands before people woke up to them. The famine in Ethiopia had been growing daily, monthly, for over a year before it suddenly hit the front pages of our news magazines and our television screens. Something has to be huge and the suffering has to be really enormous until our jaded Western appetites are titillated by it. And this is really rather horrendous, but I think that is a problem.
Mm-hmm. You wrote that we have to ask ourselves whether the brief attention given by international communities to some people in distress really alleviates their condition as much as it just assuages our consciences. Can you think of an example where you think that relief did more for the consciences of the people providing it than it did for the people it was provided to?
Well, one of the situations which I know a little bit about is that of the Cambodians, and the Cambodians were given a massive amount of relief supplies and food and financial assistance for famine relief in 1979-80. It did nothing, this relief, to help undo the real problems of the country, the real political problems, to help solve those problems. Indeed, a lot of the aid was diverted or was at least useful to the governments fighting over Cambodia, and helped build up the forces on either side and helped build up the civil war, if you like, which has continued through the 10 years since then. And we gave all this money, and I'm not saying that we should not. This is one of the dilemmas about writing about these problems in the Third World, because people turn around to you and say, well, if it all is diverted or if it all causes the problems that you say, then we should just turn our backs and do nothing, shouldn't we? And I don't think that is the answer. But nonetheless, the compassion, if you like, of people in the West aroused by the Cambodian disaster in 1979 was effective in saving hundreds of thousands of lives. But at the same time, it enabled the Vietnamese government in Phnom Penh and the Cambodian resistance led by the communist Khmer Rouge, who were the mass murderers before, to rebuild their respective forces and to continue fighting, which they have done ever since.
So have you had to examine your conscience as a journalist and ask, am I doing more harm than good by exposing some of the ways that aid has at times been diverted to the wrong people?
Well, when I was writing The Quality of Mercy, which I find absolutely impossible to write and the most difficult book I've ever written for the very issues that we're talking about, a lot of aid officials from the United Nations and some of the smaller voluntary relief agencies were appalled. And if I showed them drafts of chapters for their comments, they said, you can't publish this. If you publish this, then next time there's a famine, no one will give any money. And then, Mr. Shawcross, the deaths of all those children will be on your conscience. And I found this a rather disagreeable and unpleasant threat. And I didn't think it was true, but it certainly perhaps made me deal with, and perhaps I was wrong, I was aware that relief agencies are not the same as governments. They are ostensibly seeking to do good, and perhaps one has to judge them by slightly different standards. But maybe I was wrong. Maybe I should have been much tougher on them. I don't know.
Let me quote you again. You've said that the real needs of a country are often obscured by propaganda, sensationalism, and cliché. It's the cliché part that I find the really interesting part of that equation. That's something that we don't really consider as much as propaganda and sensationalism. Would you address the subject of clichés and how harmful they can be?
Yes, well, one Oxfam official said to me, again in the case of Cambodia, he said that when it finally became a cause célèbre in 1979, it had everything from our point of view in terms of fundraising, he said. He said it had beautiful brown people, brown, not black, he said. It had a Hitler figure, Pol Pot. It had lovely countryside and Buddhist temples and Buddhist monks in saffron roads. And he said basically it was like sex on a tiger skin. We couldn't go wrong.
A real made-for-TV movie kind of scenario.
Yes.
So this must mean that as a journalist, you try really hard to not come up with the clichés to make your case for what's going on in the world.
Well, I think one can use the clichés, but being aware of what it is and say, look, this is a cliché, but it also happens to be an accurate description of what is happening. I think one has to be aware of it oneself and, if possible, point it out to one's readers or one's audience.
Let's get back to the concept of compassion fatigue. How does that relate to journalists? How does it relate to you as a journalist?
Well, I don't know. After writing The Quality of Mercy, I haven't written, I haven't concentrated upon writing about other disasters except for Ethiopia, where I went in 84, 85. I've not spent the last 3 years continuing to write full-time about those subjects. I would like to start returning to them, and I've perhaps made a start in that by the introduction in this book. But it is a I found writing The Quality of Mercy terribly debilitating and depressing activity, and felt that I should try and do something else for at least the time being.
Yeah,
so I did get fatigued.
You've described yourself as sometimes feeling like a tourist of the refugee world.
Yes. Well, this is right. And I mean, in Thailand, for example, I would drive out from Bangkok to the refugee camps and talk to refugees and then take down their testimony and then drive back to my hotel and have a nice dinner in Bangkok with friends and be extremely comfortable. And it's awful. And that those refugees were still stuck behind that barbed wire. This happens, of course, in all sorts of journalism. It's not fundamentally different, but I found it in terms of refugee life particularly depressing. And I suppose the most obvious, the most blatant example of it was in Ethiopia, where I flew one day with the RAF, which were dropping grain to starving peasants who had, in a very mountainous area, and they'd come from hundreds of miles, literally, to pick up grain, these Ethiopian peasants and farmers. And we landed on this little tiny airstrip with a plane that could land on a very short grassy strip, and waited for the airdrop to begin. And the all day long, RAF planes came in and dropped bags of grain from a height of about 10 feet as the planes went. They were just pushed out of the hold as the plane flew over the airstrip. And then the farmers would come rushing out from the side of the airstrip to pick up the bags of grain that had fallen. And many of them had burst. And there were these bags of grain burst all over the field and the rocks. And the farmers would sweep up the individual pieces of grain one by one with little twigs and bundle them into their sacks. And we were sitting on the side of the mountain all day, just 100 yards away, I suppose. The RAF people calling in the planes, a few relief workers, and I think another journalist and myself. And we had been told by the RAF, the Royal Air Force, to bring with us lunchboxes from our hotels in Addis Ababa, which we had done. And in Addis there was no starvation, because the government made sure that the urban population was perfectly well fed. And so we had these nice lunch boxes, cardboard boxes filled with chocolates and pieces of chicken and ham sandwiches and cakes and things like that, which was rather extraordinary. And the Royal Air Force people were sitting with their big canteens of tea and eating Mars bars. And there were these people sweeping up the grain, and one could give away one's lunchbox. But 2 hours later, we got back in our plane and flew back to Addis, and it was a very nice meal in the hotel, and I just thought of those people still only an hour away, but still just sweeping up individual pieces of grain.
So in the light of that, what did you do? Did you give away your lunchbox?
I think I kept one sandwich for myself, but I gave away most of it.
I guess that's typical of the kind of paradox you confront when you're a journalist covering refugees.
Yes, but I think the problem or the difference that is happening now is that journalists have always had those paradoxes, but now it's a paradox that is confronting the whole world.
Yes, uh-huh.
And that's what is changing, and that the extraordinary sweep of communications is making it much different. I mean, for example, nowadays, and this would not have been possible 10 years ago, a television crew could go in with its own little satellite communication system and broadcast those pictures live. When I covered the Vietnam War in the early 1970s, very few live pictures got back. They were extraordinary and important, but they weren't actually happening live while you saw them. Now everything can be live all over the world, and you can carry your own little satellite communications, satellite transponders, which beams it up and beams it down from those peasants sweeping grain. And the whole of the world is involved much, much more, and that, I think, is what is difficult for everyone. And it makes compassion fatigue a much more widespread sickness than it has been until now.
I mean, you could be sitting in your living room, snacking on a sandwich you put on the TV, and you're confronting...
Something that is happening this minute.
Actually. Exactly, just yeah. As you were confronting it on the side of the road, eating your sandwich.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I want to talk with you more, but first, let's take a short break. William Shawcross is my guest, and he's written the introduction for a new book called Forced Out, The Agony of the Refugee in Our Time. We'll talk more. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is journalist William Shawcross. He began investigating the refugee situation in Southeast Asia after the Vietnam War as he researched his book Sideshow, Kissinger, Nixon, and the Destruction of Cambodia. It was about the secret bombing of Cambodia. Shawcross has written the introduction to the new book Forced Out, The Agony of the Refugee in Our Time. I should mention his latest book, The Shah's Last Ride, was about the exile of the Shah of Iran.
He was a rather... well-placed refugee in the sense that he had a lot of money, but even he couldn't find anywhere to go with all that money.
Well, you think that the whole definition of refugee, by the way, should be changed, should be broadened, because the meaning of refugee has changed. The reason for refugees,
well,
has changed.
It hasn't changed completely, and the original meaning, a refugee is someone who has a well-founded fear of persecution and has left his homeland thereby, and wishes to seek asylum elsewhere. That is still an absolutely valid reason for thousands upon thousands of people, hundreds of thousands, I would say. But it is also true that refugees now, and this is not totally new, but many refugees are fleeing not just individual persecution, but war and violence. And they seem to me to be just as needy of asylum as anyone else, and I think that that they should be treated as refugees. And there is a tendency now, and this again is linked to the speed of communications and the shrinking of the world, there is a tendency on the part of governments to denounce refugees as mere economic migrants, people who just want to improve their economic conditions. Well, this is slightly odd that they should be denounced as such if one thinks that the entire philosophy of the Western world, if you like, is based upon the idea of self-improvement and capitalist advancement, if you wish, economic advancement within a capitalist context, and to dismiss those others from the rest of the world who have similar aspirations seems to me to be, to put it mildly, to be being a bit unfair. And again, it's very hard, I think, when you have... You have the satellites obviously going both ways. You can be sitting in your living room watching live starving peasants dying in Ethiopia, and at the same time, other peasants in, say, the Philippines or Indonesia or Guatemala can be watching from the same satellites different transmissions of Dallas or Dynasty or advertisements for cars or Coca-Cola or whatever. And so the images go both ways. We see third world impoverishment and they see first world luxury. And it's not surprising that they would aspire to have some of that luxury. And it's not those advertisements and those images are meant to be enticing. And yet when they do entice people to come here or to come to Europe, we say, go to hell, get out of here.
You think prosperous countries need to re-examine the standards they use to admit refugees?
Yes, I think we do, absolutely. And in Europe, a terrible thing is happening now. In 1992, Europe is going to be a completely free and open market between the European countries. All the barriers for trade and commercial movement are coming down. But at the same time, barriers against refugees are going up. Our governments are trying to create a fortress in Europe to stop refugees coming in. And they're pretending that a huge, vast flood of people is beating at the gates of Europe, which is nonsense. Of the 14 million people who are refugees in the world today, 90% live in the poor countries of the third world. They've moved, for example, from Ethiopia to the Sudan or from El Salvador to Honduras. They're not coming into the prosperous first world. There are less than a million or so of those 14 million who are coming into the first world. And yet we are taking the most draconian measures to stop individuals getting in. And for example, there is now legislation in many European countries, including England, to punish airlines who bring in refugees. And this means that airline clerks all over the world are trying to screen passengers to determine whether they're refugees or not. Now, it's absurd for an airline clerk, a young man or woman, to have that responsibility to decide that someone should not be allowed to get on a plane, someone who has a valid ticket and probably may even have a visa, because he or she is a refugee or could be a refugee. And that's a grotesque procedure, but it's happening. And so a lot of people are being turned off planes because they're refugees. Others who get onto planes tear up their passports in the lavatory of the planes or tear up whatever papers they've managed to forge or scrounge and arrive at immigration desks in airports saying, "I'm a refugee." And some of them are subjected to the most appalling behavior. In London and Heathrow, the behavior is pretty bad towards refugees. And in many other places, I'm sure it's worse. And there is a new category of refugee now called orbit cases. And these are refugees who have been refused entry into the first country into which they have flown and have been put back on the airplane on which they arrived. And the airline has shuffled them around the world to try and find other places that will take them. And these people can be flying for literally weeks at a time, going on and on and on, trying to find a home and not succeeding.
Your father was Britain's chief prosecutor for the Nuremberg trials?
Yes, that's right.
And I was wondering if when you were growing up around the supper table, if there were a lot of discussions about the kinds of issues we've been talking about today, about compassion and cruelty.
Well, I'm sure there were. And certainly Nuremberg was something of which I was very much aware in my childhood. And we had some of those old 78 RPM discs records of the speeches at Nuremberg, which I listened to with a sort of rather awful, macabre fascination, I suppose, because they were so extraordinary. The recounting and the summing up speeches, in particular, of the prosecutors of the evils of the Nazi regime. And so I suppose that was something that I was aware of at a rather young age, the nature or the possibility of evil and the way in which it could be combated.
One of your best-known books is really about American policy, about the American secret bombing of Cambodia. And I'm curious about how you became involved as a British journalist writing about America.
Well, I don't know why someone else, an American, should have written that book. I'm sure could have done it much better. I was in Vietnam and briefly in Cambodia as a journalist for the Sunday Times in London. And then I was working in Washington in 1972-73 as a congressional fellow working in Capitol Hill. And I was just very much caught up, first of all, in Watergate and was very much aware of what was going on in Indochina. I went back in 74 and 75 and at the time of the fall of Saigon. And then in the end of 75, terrible stories began to come out of Cambodia about the brutality of the Khmer Rouge victors who had won the war in 75 and imposed the most vicious draconian regime upon the country, driving everyone out of the country, out of the cities, into the countryside, and imposing a very, very bloody form of Stalinist dictatorship. And I went to talk to refugees in Thailand about what was going on under the Khmer Rouge, and their stories seemed to me to be unbelievable but true. It seemed extraordinary that any regime would behave like this, but nonetheless, these people were not, it seemed to me, to be lying. So I came back and persuaded the Sunday Times to let me do a long investigation into what had happened in Cambodia in the last 10 years and how this group, the Khmer Rouge, had come to take power, who they were, and what had happened in the country. And I wrote this and then decided that I'd like to write a book about it.
I'm thinking about what an interesting situation it must be to be a journalist and find all these refugees who are telling you these harrowing stories that you figure must be true. On the other hand, they're unbelievable, and you have to document if they're true or not, what you were just describing.
Yes, it is difficult. And at that time, a lot of people, particularly on the left, did not wish to believe the horror stories of the Khmer Rouge. And they said, oh, this is just the bloodbath theory that American officials had been trotting out for years and years to justify the American presence in Indochina. It's CIA-inspired, and so on and so on. And there was a reluctance to believe that it was the case. But it seemed to me that, unbelievable though the stories sounded, the refugees were telling the truth. And so it turned out when finally people were allowed into Cambodia in 1979 and saw the mass graves of the victims of the Khmer Rouge, the piles of skulls, which we can all remember.
What was your reaction the first time you were shown a mass grave?
I thought very much about Nuremberg. And I that was in 1980, when I went to Cambodia after the Khmer Rouge had been overthrown by the Vietnamese and was taken straight from the airport by a guide from the foreign ministry to a site just outside Phnom Penh where they had just uncovered another mass grave, and all the bones were piled in different piles, the skulls in one pile and the leg bones in another, and arms. It was, and these people had been killed only a few months before, about 9-10 months before. And it was absolutely appalling, and the smell of decaying flesh was still all over the place, and it reminded me very much of the descriptions in some of my father's speeches in the Nuremberg prosecution about the mass graves that the Nazis had created and people being herded into them and shot by SS troops. And I had never expected and certainly had never wished to see anything of the sort myself, and yet here it was, a similar outrage which had been perpetrated only a few months ago, not 40 years ago.
I guess you and your father were in a similar business in the sense of trying to get to the truth, to get to the bottom of things about this kind of brutality.
Yes, lawyers and journalists, I think, would very often say that they were not in the same business, but I suppose then in terms of sifting evidence, yes, that's true.
Are you working on another book now?
Yeah, I am. It's rather different, but it embraces some of the issues that we've been talking about. It's looking at the new global media empires, and whereas we've always had press barons like William Randolph Hearst in this country and others, we have never yet had global media barons. And now we do for the first time, and the most important of them is Rupert Murdoch, who was an Australian but is now an American citizen. And his media empire is the biggest and the most important of the global media empires, which and I'm trying to look at this and see how it affects the way in which news and politics is conducted. And I don't quite know which direction the book will go, but that's what I'm trying to look at now, which is rather different from what I've been writing about in the past, but does, as I say, embrace some of the same issues of perception and communication.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure.
My guest has been journalist William Shawcross. He's the author of Sideshow, The Quality of Mercy, and The Shah's Last Ride. He's written the introduction for a new book called Forced Out, The Agony of the Refugee in Our Time. It's edited by Carol Kaczmarek, and it's an unusual collaboration of four different publishing companies, Random House, Norton, Morrow, and Penguin. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time we meet Tim Cahill, an adventure writer who often thinks of himself as a coward. He was once described as a gonzo John McPhee. His essays are collected in the new book, A Wolverine is Eating My Leg. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Galway Kinnell has a new poem about isolation and alienation. Coming up, he reads from this unpublished poem called When One Has Lived a Long Time Alone, and we talk about the personal experiences that led to the poem. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles rhythm and blues artist William Bell. Bell gave Stax Records one of their first hits, wrote the blues classic Born Under a Bad Sign, and gained a reputation as the most literate soul writer this side of Smokey Robinson. And our book critic John Leonard has a review of The Lost Father, Marina Warner's new novel about three generations of women and their family myths. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Michael Richards. Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev today said Central America's problem should be solved only by political means. And in a speech to Cuba's parliament, Gorbachev said there's a real possibility of peace in the region and called for a halt to all military supplies bound for Central America. The Kremlin leader is wrapping up his visit to Cuba. He heads tomorrow for London. Earlier today, seven Cuban dissidents were arrested in Havana before the start of a planned demonstration in support of reforms that Gorbachev has implemented in the Soviet Union. The State Department condemned the arrests, saying they underline the need for ongoing monitoring of the human rights situation in Cuba. President Bush got a key endorsement for his plan to give non-lethal aid to the Contras today from Costa Rican President Oscar Arias. Arias met with the president at the White House. More from NPR's Jim Engel.
Arias became the first Central American leader to publicly embrace the recent compromise between the White House and Congress, which will continue humanitarian aid to the Contras until after Nicaraguan elections early next year. Some critics have suggested funding the Contras until then is a violation of the peace plan recently signed by five Central American presidents. The plan calls for disbanding the Contras and for democratic reforms in Nicaragua, including elections. Arias said today, Central American leaders envision the same sequence of events the Bush administration does.
The democratization of Nicaragua and the relocation and repatriation of the Contras should be a simultaneous move.
Arias, who has been the leading force for peace efforts in the region, said he is satisfied and proud of the Bush compromise with Congress because the United States will now be speaking with one voice on Central American policy and because the U.S. is supporting in good faith diplomatic efforts to find peace. I'm Jim Engel at the White House.
The International Monetary Fund today welcomed a new American plan to help ease the debt burden for third world countries. But the IMF stopped short of giving the proposal its full endorsement. While supporting the concept of debt reduction, the committee decided to study certain key aspects of the U.S. proposal further after some of its members expressed fears that the plan could lead to a government bailout of commercial banks. The IMF and the World Bank are holding their spring meeting in Washington. One of Oliver North's former colleagues testified today that he had great doubts about North's truthfulness and the legality of many of North's actions. More from NPR's Nina Totenberg.
Vincent Canestrero, a CIA official who worked with Oliver North at the National Security Council, was originally called by the defense, but today he came under rigorous cross-examination. He acknowledged that in September 1984, he came across Oliver North drafting answers to congressional questions and that he told North he did not think the answers North was preparing were truthful. "Did you make a gesture?" Prosecutor Kecker asked. Canestrero resisted at first, but then, ordered to by the judge, he demonstrated a gesture he'd used when talking to North, pulling his fingers off his nose to indicate a Pinocchio-type lie, a growing nose. Canestrero acknowledged that he told the grand jury 2 years ago, "With Colonel North, you could never be certain if what he was telling you was true or fantasy or meant to mislead you. My modus operandi," Canestrero said, "was to take everything he said with four grains of salt." I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
The House Ethics Committee is looking into charges that Speaker Jim Wright may have accepted $100,000 in unreported gifts from a former business associate. The panel today talked to two men involved in a deal, a real estate deal with Wright. The committee plans to resume its closed-door deliberations tomorrow on a long list of possible rules violations by Wright. Stock prices were lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell nearly 7 points to close at 2298.20. Declines led advances 4-3 on a volume of 161 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange lost 9 cents. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Otis Redding, Sam and Dave, Carla Thomas, and Booker T and the MGs, all recorded for Stax Records during its heyday in the mid to late 60s. So did William Bell. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward pays tribute to the Stax talent who wasn't as famous as the rest.
The success of Stax Records in the 60s was, like the success of Motown, due to an almost family-like atmosphere that brought producers, musicians, and songwriters into close daily contact and made it almost inevitable that they'd work together as smoothly as the workings of a Swiss watch. But it was rare that anybody in this group wore two hats, which is what makes William Bell so unusual. Bell was born in 1939, and his real name is William Yarborough, but people thought he resembled his grandmother, Bell, so much that the nickname stuck. By the time he reached Stax in 1962, he'd been around Memphis a long time, doing the usual round of nightclubs and talent shows, and recording the usual number of obscure flops. He heard that Stax was looking for material, so he headed to their studios to cut an audition tape of a song he'd written, You Don't Miss Your Water. But when the producers heard it, they decided to turn it into a finished record, and it became one of the Memphis label's first hits. Of course, when he recorded it, he'd been waiting for his draft notice, and the Army took him for 3 years. When he got out, Stax was a going concern, and they had plenty of stars. Bell willingly went to work as a songwriter, turning out numbers like Born Under a Bad Sign for Albert King and collaborating with the house keyboard player Booker T. Jones. Eventually, though, Stax started letting him record again, and although he never really scored a smash, the quality was very high.
Since I've been gone, you've had your number changed. Remains the same. Now I've been loving you, and you've been loving me so long. Baby, what's wrong?
Private Number was a duet with Judy Clay, who never did so well as when she was recording with Bell. But he did all right on his own, too.
Have I told you lately that I love you? Well, if I didn't, darling, I'm sorry. Did I reach out and hold you in my loving arms? When you needed me, now I realize that you need love too, and I'll spend my life making up to you. Oh, I forgot to be your lover, and I'm sorry, I'm so sorry.
Songs like I Forgot to Be Your Lover are what are now considered deep soul, without a catchy pop hook in the chorus and a deeper, more narrative style that takes ears more accustomed to hearing black church services to decipher. And although it never really scratched the pop charts, it was a top 10 hit on black stations, particularly in the South. Another thing about William Bell was that he was uncommonly literate for a soul writer, perhaps second only to Smokey Robinson in that respect.
I wake up in the mornings, I think I want a drink. Can't even get water from the kitchen sink. The dog that we both loved and raised from a pup tried to bite my hand, Lord, every time I pick him up. Because I did you wrong, my whole world is falling down. Ooh, yeah, now crumbling all around me. All around.
This was the cue that Stax needed to start promoting him as their house intellectual, and they sent out a promo picture that showed Bell looking moody and smoking a pipe. But as Stax entered the era of Shaft and protest music, Bell didn't fit in. Sounded uncomfortable, and soon he'd been dropped. Still, his decade at Stax stood him in good stead. He moved to Atlanta, where he started a modestly successful soul label, Peachtree Productions, and studied acting. He even starred as Stanley Kowalski in a production of A Streetcar Named Desire. William Bell is still active in the music business around Atlanta, and I'm sure that people looking for superb songs to record will dip into his extensive catalog for years to come.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll.
Looking, you're always on the roam. When you can't take care of what you've got at home, women in the streets are looking good to you, but don't you know your woman is looking good to somebody too? Yeah.
This is Fresh Air. Poet Galway Kinnell won the 1983 Pulitzer Prize for his book Selected Poems. After reading the collection, critic and poet Robert Haas wrote, "It is increasingly clear that Kinnell's ambition all along has been to hold death up to life, as if he had it by the scruff of the neck, and to keep it there until he enacted a blessing from it." Kinnell published his first book of poems in 1960, which included his best-known poem, The Avenue Bearing the Initial Christ into the New World. Since 1981, Kinnell has taught at New York University. He also directs NYU's creative writing program. Kinnell was a guest lecturer at the University of Pennsylvania last week. We invited him into our studio to discuss his work and to read from his new unpublished poem called When One Has Lived a Long Time Alone. It's a poem in 11 stanzas. He read the eighth.
When one has lived a long time alone, one likes alike the pig, who brooks no deferment of gratification, and the porcupine or thorned pig, who enters the cellar, but not the house itself, due to eating down the cellar stairs on the way up. And one likes the worm, who by bunching herself together and expanding, rubs her way through the ground, no less than the butterfly, who totters full of worry among the daylilies as they darken. And more, one finds one likes any other species better than one's own, which has gone amuck, making one self-estranged when one has lived a long time alone.
This is a poem about living in exile from people, in a way, and, mm-hmm. and having this temporary bond with insects and animals and
yeah, kind of,
instead of people.
It's living alone, and it's living kind of bitterly alone in a way, and so it could be characterized as depression. However, depression usually doesn't have that lively interest oh. in other beings.
Yeah.
You know, depression generally closes off interest in everything, so it isn't really depression. It's more misanthropy, really. But it's got something. It's connected to depression.
Is this a period you feel like you're in now?
No. That is behind me. The period ended the moment I put the last touch, the finishing touch on the poem.
So you started
There's no connection between finishing the poem and the termination of that period. But it just did happen that for a year and a half I lived in rather severe isolation.
Can I ask what brought you back from that court exile?
Well, in part it was discussions with a very wise doctor that I've been seeing. In part it was escaping from the clutches of psychopharmacologists. In part, it was deciding to rejoin the species. And in part, it was falling in love. And finally, it was climbing a mountain. This was in northern Italy. Along the path, there were little tableaus showing the life of Jesus. And it begins, the first tableau, it's a path that leads up to a church quite high along on a cliff. And the first tableau at the bottom shows Jesus being born and calling out or whatever. You could see his mouth is open. And, of course, there are animals in the barn where he's born. And they all must be making a kind of wonderful, harmonious music together, and loving people are hovering over this child. So the child is born in complete kinship and in oneness with all the other species, the way our species was born and the way each of us individually is born. And then the tableaus show the gradual isolation of this man. The thing about those later tableaus was that this was extremely beautiful place where I was, extremely beautiful. So the thing about those later tableaus was that these depictions of heaven with their all the gold and the angels singing and everything, it looked awfully tawdry compared with this world where I was actually standing. You know, and I turned from the tableaus and looked at our world and saw how extraordinarily beautiful it is. Something happened to me, and some kind of peace and fearlessness came into me, which haven't left me. So those are some of the things, I think, that have roused me from this this misanthropic isolation. And I cannot believe that I will ever fall back into it again. I just can't think that would happen. Don't call me up, though.
And check. You strike me as someone who consciously or unconsciously allows himself to experience emotional extremes.
Well, I think it's in that,
and then end up writing about it in some way.
It seems to be in the nature of the art, really. I don't think that I'm, a very clear example of this myself, but I feel it in myself too, and it's something like that, of exposing oneself to, allowing oneself to carry an emotional state to pretty far.
I want to quote something that Donald Hall, the writer, once said in talking about your work and in talking about what your work was not. He said, there's a lot of poetry that is too damn life-affirming, not seriously life-affirming, just affirmative, like the boosters in Reader's Digest. And this was an example of what your poems were not.
Oh, good.
he says, but Cannell knows we live by emptying ourselves. I don't know what he means by that myself, but... but I was wondering if you would agree with Donald Hall there that too much poetry is consciously life-affirming and superficial in its own way.
I don't know if what poetry.
Let me put it this way: yeah. Let me ask you if you share his distrust of life-affirming poems.
I would, in discovering a life-affirming poem, I would want to know through the poem if there's some area of some crucial area of experience had been left out, some troubling area of experience had been glossed over, and that I would want to know if it was at the price of ignorance that peace was achieved, and in which case it wouldn't be interesting.
This might sound like an off-the-wall question to you, but we've been talking mostly about isolation, alienation, things like that. A friend of a friend was saying that when they used to see your readings, this was years ago they were referring to, that after the reading there would always be like swarms of young women coming up to the podium to try to meet you, poetry groupies, as she called them.
That's mostly a myth.
Is it?
But in any case, even to the degree that it is not a myth, the kind of special attention you get when you're on a stage, you know, especially when you're reading poetry, which touches people in their hearts, you know, and causes them to come up to you afterwards more openly.
Yeah.
That kind of renders all the more sharp the contrast between the life of on the stage and normal life afterwards. So there might have been, of course, everybody who gives readings publicly, you know, knows there are these bright moments when everyone loves you and makes a lot of you, but it doesn't mean anything really. Afterwards you go back to your normal life, and poems are not written on stages. Poems are written in dingy attics. And there's no way around it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your poems. Thank you.
A pleasure.
Poet Galway Kinnell. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a preview of All Things Considered. What's coming up, Noah?
Hi, Terry. On tonight's program, NPR's Daniel Zwerdling, who's been in Valdez, Alaska, and reporting from Prince William Sound, tonight tells us how the people, the fishermen and the townspeople, are doing in the small port city of Valdez, Alaska, how they're feeling about the oil spill, which was a week ago on Friday. Also, our series on Black Americans and AIDS continues, the impact on the Black community by AIDS. Tonight, the story of a mother who has AIDS and whose baby died of AIDS. And our series of reports by Daniel Pinkwater concludes tonight about his growing up to be an artist. Tonight, we learn how his career as a sculptor came to an end.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The Lost Father is a new novel by the British writer Marina Warner. She's also written two previous novels and three nonfiction books about history, art, and feminism. Book critic John Leonard has this review of The Lost Father.
A decade ago, when Marina Warner published her first novel, In a Dark Wood, I found myself wishing she wouldn't write any more of them. Her nonfiction books on the Virgin Mary and Joan of Arc in history and mythology had been wonderful, but her novel was talky and symbol fraught. On the face of its pale action, too many ideas had been fixed like adhesive plasters. She went ahead and wrote a second novel anyway, The Skating Party, not much more satisfying than the first, and then a terrific art book, Monuments and Maidens, which seemed to prove my point. With her third novel, though, she proves a point of her own. The Lost Father, about how three generations of women cope with the paterfamilias who dies on them by mythologizing the reasons for his death, is full of ideas, while at the same time skeptical of them, and full of landscape, from southern Italy to London, New York, and southern California, and full of music, mostly Italian opera, and full of history, which is itself a kind of opera, or at least an operetta, from Mussolini's fascism to Hollywood's hedonism. The Lost Father is also full of life, amplitude, lyric exaltation, and an amazing number of animal and marine life metaphors: dolphins, spiders, mollusks, butterflies, hedgehogs, beetles, toads, the lace-making coral under the sea, an ostrich, and a worm. The ecology of memory. Anna Pitagora, who works in contemporary London for a museum of ephemera, is writing her mother's memoirs for her. Fantina, the mother, has led Anna to believe that her Italian grandfather, David, as a student, had been wounded in a duel over his sister's honor. From complications of this wound, he's supposed to have died 20 years later, after leaving Italy for New York and returning with four female children to practice law, sing baritone, and miss the point of Mussolini. This is the family myth. From David's own diaries, we begin to suspect that it may be as unreliable as the Pitagora family superstitions about sex and religion. For all his purported gentleness, David was too much in love with pistols. Besides, everybody in the novel is always reminding us that everything is make-believe, like opera, and that make-believe is better than happenstance because it's more beautiful. Reality, says David, will never do. Family memories are in fact a kind of museum of ephemera, like Anna's candy wrappers and junk food cartons. From them we fabricate an appropriate past, our notions of love and honor. By reinventing their father, David's daughters hid from themselves. His granddaughters need to penetrate this mystification, and the mystifications as well of the astonishing sisterhood that mothered them so variously, in order to be free adults. Before Anna can see the men in her own life clearly, she must look David in the face. And that face is not at all the picture that's been handed down. What if survival were at stake, not honor, at the dawn of the myth? Not sex, but politics. Not romance, but revolution. What truth does Anna want or need? Warner gets tricky at the end, as if playing with these ghosts, as if to suggest that ideologies themselves, socialism, fascism, feminism, might be superstitions too. She's so wise now as a novelist, she no longer tells us what to think. She sings a bit and winks and spreads her lacework fan like coral, fragile, fine-spun, intricate in time's waters.
Jen Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Lost Father by Marina Warner. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Dangerous Liaisons, Mississippi Burning, Working Girl, and all of Woody Allen's films since Bananas were cast by Juliette Taylor. On the next Fresh Air, we meet one of the top casting directors in the business. Also, classical music critic Lord Schwartz reviews a new recording of Russell Sherman playing the piano music of Liszt. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg examines how words like terrorism and Holocaust are misused in political and social commentary. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Fred Landerl. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistants from Christopher Cook. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.